Welcome, everybody. This is Lecture 7 of the Mises Academy class, Anatomy of the Fed. This is the second time we've offered this class. Today is August 6, 2012, and this is, as I say, Lecture 7, which focuses on unconventional Fed operations. So here's the outline. You can see we've got a lot of material to cover. Before I dive into all of these particulars, though, let me just step back, because I realized when I was thinking about the lecture here right before we started, I don't think I explained this distinction between conventional and unconventional in these slides, so let me just do that right now before we start dealing with the individual slides. All right, so last week in Lecture 6, we talked about conventional Fed operations. So that was textbook discussion of how did the Federal Reserve, or in general, how did the central bank influence the economy. And so there we talked about how for a long time now, what the Federal Reserve has done is it targets what's called the federal funds rate. And that was the way it would express its policy objectives. All right, so it's a bit confused, it's a bit more complicated than that. I mean, what the Fed says it's trying to do is keep unemployment low and inflation low, by which they mean price inflation. But it's not like the Fed actually, when it announces what it's doing, says, oh, we're now going to make unemployment 7.8% next month. That's not the way they couch their specific objectives. Rather, what they have said for decades now is our target for the federal funds rate is such and such. And so that's what the press means when they say, oh, the Fed announced today it's going to cut interest rates. That meant they were going to lower the federal funds rate. And then how do they actually do it? Well, in practice, they typically would buy and sell assets, and so those are called open market operations, so that the open market fund at the New York Federal Reserve would be in charge of doing that primarily, and they would buy and sell assets, and then in so doing, the Fed's balance sheet would change, and the amount of reserves in the commercial banking sector would change. And so since the federal funds rate is the interest rate the commercial banks charge each other on overnight loans of reserves, by adjusting the quantity of those reserves through buying and selling of assets, the Fed could indirectly get the federal funds rate to be whatever it wanted to be. So I didn't show it to you, but if you looked at a chart, you could graph the actual effective federal funds rate, meaning like the market rate itself, versus the Fed's target for that particular rate. And you'd see they're not identical, but they're pretty close. So there is that distinction. So just keep that in mind, that in practice, typically what the Fed had been doing up until this crisis, and not since its founding, but I'm saying for a long time, like this was the norm for at least, let's say, two decades. I would have to go look at and get the exact timing for when they switched from one approach to another. But clearly for a while now, what the Fed would do is say, if we want to ease because we think unemployment's too high and we're okay with price inflation getting higher, we'll cut interest rates, and in particular the federal funds rate. And if we think price inflation's getting to be too high and we're okay with unemployment going up, then we'll raise interest rates. And the way they would do that is selling off assets that sucks reserves out of the system, and that pulls up the federal funds rate. Right? So it's not price control in the same way that a city government would say, we want to lower rents, and so we're going to put a ceiling. When the Fed changes interest rates, it does it by sucking out or pumping in reserves, and then that, through normal supply and demand, affects the market interest rate on borrowing those reserves. Okay, so that's conventional Fed operations. That's the kind of stuff you'd see in a textbook. Now, unconventional Fed operations. Here, what we're talking about in this lecture is everything that the Fed has been doing since this particular crisis really kicked in. So we'll be talking about stuff that actually the Fed started doing back in at least as early as December of 2007, but then really they started ramping up all the stuff in 2008 in particular from September 2008 onward. All right, so here what we're going to see is the Fed is doing all kinds of stuff beyond merely buying and selling assets in an attempt to move the total quantity of commercial bank reserves to make the actual federal funds rate hit whatever the Fed's target is. So there's several reasons for why they started doing these other things, and I'll talk about them. One reason, but not the only reason, so make sure you get this. One reason is that the federal funds rate basically got pushed down to zero. I mean, technically, I think it's between the way they state currently the federal funds target rate is to say between 0 and 25 basis points. So in case you don't know, a basis point is 1/100th of a percentage point. So 25 basis points, or they might say 25 bips, BPS, means 0.25%. So right now, I think the actual Fed's official target for the federal funds rate is just a range they give, and they say between 0 and 25 basis points. So that's basically as low as it can go. And since the economy still is awful, clearly the Fed needs to do something besides that if you're of the mindset that it's the central bank's job to help the economy when it's in a bad recession. But as we'll see, that's not the full story. So don't think, I mean, the way, if you read Krugman and guys like that, they make it sound like everything about this recession has been, you know, the reason this is complicated is that, oh, gee, the according to Keynesian theory, the aggregate supply and demand analysis and that sort of thing, shucks, what happened is the actual full employment market clearing interest rate right now, real interest rate, would be very negative, and even the nominal rate, given current price inflation expectations, would be negative, and the Fed can't push rates, can't push nominal rates below zero, and so that's why now we need something else. Because once the Fed pushes nominal interest rates to zero, it's out of ammunition, conventional ammunition, and so now the Fed has to raise long-term inflation expectations, so that even with the nominal zero rate, if people think prices are going to go up more quickly over time, then the real interest rate gets pushed lower correspondingly. And so that can be what induces households and businesses to spend more, whether they're investing more or consuming more. And that, after all, is what we need to fix the economy. We need people to spend more to boost aggregate demand to get all these workers employed again. Okay, so with that framework, and knowing that the Fed, in practice, has pushed short-term interest rates down to zero, you might think, oh, so what happened is, in practice, Bernanke pushed short-term interest rates down, 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 oh, and then he hit zero, and then they said, shoot, the economy's still awful, I guess now let's start doing some unconventional stuff. But as we'll see, that's not what happened. The Fed already was doing unconventional stuff before short-term interest rates were basically zero. So just keep that in mind, that things are not as simple as Bernanke tried his standard tool kit. They weren't working, and so then he started brainstorming. That's actually not how it played out in practice. The Fed was already doing emergency stuff, giving billions of dollars to the bankers before the federal funds rate was basically zero. So interpret that as you will. Okay, so let's jump in here. Okay, so the problems here, what I mean is, what are some of the things going on with the economy that apparently called for a more sophisticated response from the Fed than the simple textbook solution of, oh, just lower interest rates? Let me also, because we're being in an Austrian environment here, it may help for some of you to just be refreshed as to the conventional story. So the conventional story is, let me see if I can find a, let me do it right here. So here, so that's 0%. And the idea is, so this is the interest rate. And the idea is that you got your aggregate supply. Now, I'm going to mix this up a little bit, but it's something like this. It really should be ISLM curves. But the idea is the market clearing interest rate is negative, where it would be full employment. So, actually, I'm going to move away from this because I'm going to botch. I shouldn't be trying to do Keynesian stuff off the top of my head. I should know better than that. Let me tell you verbally what the Keynesian story is. Because this is what the conventional macro plan, central planning, what the role of the central bank is, philosophy. Okay, so it's Keynesian at its core. I mean, they can call it new Keynesian, and they can have all kinds of bells and whistles to update it. But basically, their point is they think there's a trade-off, at least in the short run, between inflation and unemployment. And when they say inflation, they mean price inflation. And so they think, other things equal, the lower interest rates are, the more people will spend. Right? The lower interest rates are, the more businesses are willing to invest. And for the same kind of reason that an Austrian would say, right, at a lower interest rate, certain projects now appear profitable that wouldn't have appeared profitable at a higher interest rate because the cost of capital is lower. So that's straightforward, that you're going to go ahead and invest in certain things, certain projects, as a business person at lower interest rates as compared to higher interest rates. So that will induce you to borrow and invest more. Or even if you're sitting on cash, you would be more willing to invest it possibly, yeah, well, the lower the interest rate, if by cash we mean like you have bonds and things, the treasuries, right? So rather than having your money earning interest, if they lower interest rates after a while, you say, well, I'm barely earning anything, keeping my money in bonds and whatever, let me put it directly and spend it on a project. All right, so there's that issue. And then, of course, households, similar thing, the lower interest rates are, other things equal, the more they're going to spend. Typically, you would think of it as them spending on consumption goods, but you could also imagine them buying durable goods like cars and things, the lower interest rates go, or houses. Right? So that's the standard Keynesian analysis, and so that's how the Fed is supposed to help the economy. When there's a recession, among other ways of describing it, they're going to say, oh, there's a shortfall of aggregate demand, and so we got to boost aggregate demand, and so how do we do it? Well, we lower interest rates. But the issue is that possible downside, of course, is the way they do that. How do they lower interest rates? They print up more money and pump it in. And so even the Keynesians are aware that, well, gee, if you keep doing that, that's going to raise inflation expectations, and just putting more money in the hands of people will cause spending to go up, and just the lower interest rate increasing spending. And so for a given aggregate supply curve, if you push up the aggregate demand curve past the point of full employment, well, then all that does is start raising prices. Right. So in the sort of naive original 1950s, 1960s Keynesian view, if that's the way you're looking at the world, that's why stagflation was supposed to be impossible. The trade-off was supposed to be between inflation and unemployment, and the thinking was you could always restore full employment. It's just if you overdid it, then the economy would start overheating. And then, you know, once you had everyone back to work, if the Fed kept pumping in more and more money, that's not going to increase real output because there's actual genuine constraints in terms of natural resources and workers and stuff like that. So, yeah, you just keep dumping more dollar bills into the economy once everybody's fully employed. Even the Keynesians knew that's just going to raise price tags. But they thought up until that point, it's largely increasing real output if there's idle capacity. So they thought dumping more dollars in will cause spending to go up, and that will mostly just absorb all the unemployed workers and the idle factories and all that kind of stuff. And so you won't see price tags rising too much until the point once everybody's fully employed, and then you just see prices go up. So if you've taken mainstream economics classes, that's the way you see that, is having something like this with the short run aggregate supply curve that's like that. So if aggregate demand is here at first, and then you boost it out to there, you're mostly getting an increase in output, and prices just go up a little bit. But then if you boost aggregate demand again, after you've reached the point where this short-run supply curve starts zooming upward, then you're mostly just raising prices. So here, price is on the y-axis, and real output is on the x-axis. All right, so that's kind of the macro Keynesian view of things. So what I'm saying is everybody recognizes there's something a lot, there's more than just that stuff going on with this particular recession. And so let me just walk through some of the issues here. Okay, so things called MBS and CDOs, that stands for mortgage-backed securities, and a more general term that includes that, collateralized debt obligations. So that's what people mostly had in mind when they were talking about toxic assets back in 2007 and 2008. So you may remember people discussing those things. All right, so I can't delve into this too much in the Q&A if you want to bring up some things, or in the office hours this week, I'd be happy to elaborate. But let me just make sure we all have a general understanding of these main issues. Okay, so these mortgage-backed securities, where did that come from? Well, just the term itself means a security is a financial asset that is like a bond, right? It would pay you fixed payments, but where was it getting the revenue from? Well, from mortgages. So they were securities that were backed by mortgages. All right, so how are these things made? Well, first of all, you had commercial banks all over the country that were granting conventional mortgages to buyers. Well, not even just conventional ones, even crazy mortgages like no money down, or mortgages where the principal could even go up later, and they weren't checking to see if you had a job, that kind of stuff, and massive balloon payments and so forth. But the point is, originally, commercial banks all over the country are giving a mortgage to a buyer, like a couple who wants to buy a house, and they're getting a mortgage, or some police officer who's retired and he's taking his retirement savings and he wants to just start investing in houses to flip them. He has to go to a bank and get a mortgage to be able to do that, right? So the commercial banks grant these mortgages to all these buyers. The buyers then, of course, go out and start buying the houses, and so that's pushing up house prices. But then the bank, the commercial bank that granted the mortgage to the actual borrower, doesn't hold the mortgage. Instead, it sells it to Wall Street, so some big investment bank on Wall Street. So now the Wall Street firm takes perhaps thousands of these individual mortgages from across the country. So 30 from Boca Raton, 30 from San Diego, 30 from Las Vegas, 30 from Cincinnati. See what I'm saying? They're from all over the country, and puts them into this one pool. So now every month, the conventional home buyers, assuming they still have a job and are making their payments, all those mortgage payments every month flow into this giant pool. And then what the Wall Street firm does is it slices and dices those cash flows and sells off derivative claims on that cash flow to different types of investors. And each of these new instruments that are called mortgage-backed securities have certain properties in terms of risk and reward, or risk and return. So if they're selling it to somebody So the way, I mean, just picture it. It's like money coming into this pool, and if everybody pays, the pool gets filled up to the top that month. But if 10% of the people default and don't pay that month, then, you know, they're late on their mortgage payment, let's say, well, then the pool only gets filled up 90%, and so on, right? So the Wall Street firms selling off assets that are derivatives of this, of these mortgages, if they want to sell something that's very high risk, it'll be what's called a riskier tranche. So the tranche is like the components of this pool. And that might like give you a claim and say you're entitled to the top 1% of that pool. So if it comes in, you get it. But there's a chance it won't come in. In other words, if anybody in this pool of 1,000 mortgages spread across the country, if anyone starts, you know, misses a payment that month, then that's out of your pocket. That money that would have gone to the pool and then to you now doesn't go to you. Whereas somebody who wants to be really safe might get a claim on the bottom 5% of that pool. So what they're buying is a claim on a share of the bottom 5% of the money flowing into this pool of 1,000 mortgages. So they know the only way they're going to miss their scheduled payment, right, because the mortgage-backed security is telling them, so long as the money's there, every month you will get X dollars. That's what you're buying, is that you're buying a claim on the future cash flows. And then they pay the Wall Street Bank accordingly for the present value of this instrument or this asset. Right? So they're pretty sure that those stated payments are going to come because they're getting, you know, in other words, for them to miss out on their money of those 1,000 mortgages, more than 950 people would have to miss their payment that month in order to start tapping into that bottom 5%, because they only take the blow after 95% have missed the payment, and then only then do they start taking a hit. So you ever see how that works? So there's different risk characteristics, and then of course investors aren't stupid. The price at which the Wall Street Bank can sell off these mortgage-backed securities, depending on the different tranches, is dependent on how risky they are. So for a given potential stream of cash flow, the really risky ones, they can only sell those off when they go to auction them or whatever, or when they just cut deals and sell them. They can charge they can only get a much lower price for those than they can get for the cash flows based on the bottom of the bucket, because those cash flows are so much more certain. So what that means is the investor who buys the real risky thing, he knows he might lose his money or he might lose some of it, but if things turn out well and most people make their mortgage payments, his implied rate of return is really high because he's not going to put that much down up front for that claim on the top 5% of the money going into that pool, whereas the guy at the bottom has to pay top dollar to get the claim on those things because those cash flows are almost certain. So his implied rate of return on his investment is very low. Okay, so that's how these things are built. So the big problem with all this stuff is that, this point right here, the computer models that the Wall Street firms and then the companies that were buying these things, they were very complicated securities, and that was part of the issue. I mean, after the fact, I interviewed some people who were working for these investment banks and whatever, and people, many of them who were Austrians. I mean, they were, you know, fans of the Austrian school, but it just so happened they worked in the financial sector. And I was asking them afterwards, yeah, I know we talk about the Fed and everything, but just you tell me from your own experience, what the heck happened? Like, why were people being so stupid? And part of the explanation was they're saying these things were really complicated. No one really understood how they worked. So that was part of the issue, is that they had these really complicated things that you needed to be, in some cases, you literally had to have a PhD in physics and have this complicated computer program just to evaluate this asset because it was so complex. It wasn't just that you were buying a mortgage. You were buying this thing that gave you certain derived claims on these uncertain cash flows that were based on thousands of mortgages. Because what they would do, too, is it was actually more complicated than what I just said. It wasn't that they would take 1,000 mortgages and dump them all into one bucket. Rather, they would have 1,000 buckets, and they'd have 1,000,000 mortgages, and they would take all the 1,000,000 mortgages and put them into one thing, and then make that mix go fill up 1,000 different buckets. So it was like each bucket had 1/1,000th of the 1,000,000 mortgages, if you get what I'm saying. So they had little pieces of mortgages from all over the place that were going into each of these things. So what's the problem with that? Well, the major intellectual error with these models was that they assumed that all real estate markets were local. I mean, and that's a cliche, that real estate is local. And so what happened is, I'm making these numbers up, and I just want to give you the idea. So let's say the model assumed, so it wasn't that the models thought real estate always has to go up. That's not true. So I've heard some people say that oh, these idiot investors on Wall Street thought that real estate couldn't go down. That's not really the issue. They knew real estate could go down, but the problem was they thought these events would be independent, if you understand statistical terminology. So in other words, they thought, okay, yeah, we know that the San Diego real estate market might go down 5% in a given year. That could happen. And so let's say that the chance of that happening is 1%. Okay. And we also know that the Tallahassee market in Florida could go down by 5% in a year. What's the chance of that? Let's say there's a 1% chance of that happening. But so now they thought the San Diego real estate market and the Tallahassee real estate market are totally unconnected because real estate is local. So they thought the probability of both the San Diego and the Tallahassee real estate markets going down 5% simultaneously is only 1/10,000th, right? That 1% times 1%. You get what I'm saying? So that was they were saying that the chance of these isolated things happening simultaneously across several major real estate markets, they thought was vanishingly small because they thought that would be like rolling snake eyes 8 times in a row. So that's why, if you may have heard anecdotes thrown around saying things like, according to these Wall Street computer models, that these guys called quants, they literally have like PhDs in physics and stuff, because the math that you use to do these evaluations of these financial instruments is the same type of math that you use in certain applications in physics. So that's why physics PhDs actually were flown into Wall Street during the peak bubble years, because the training they got getting their PhD in physics was actually what you needed to do the math for solving these equations and figuring out what the arbitrage free price is for this kind of mortgage-backed security and that kind of stuff. All right, so these models, you might have heard things saying like, oh, the actual housing collapse, these models thought would have been a 1 in a 1,000,000 year event. You might hear things like that, or it's probably more like one every 10 million years. So they're saying the models thought the probability of what actually happened with the fall we saw in real estate prices across the country beforehand, when they were evaluating the riskiness of these mortgage-backed securities, they would have said that the probability of that event happening was like 1 in a 1,000,000 years. Like it should only happen once every 10 million years, something like that. And again, the reason for that is because they assumed these events were independent, that real estate was local. So that was a major thing going on, and so that's partly why you had all of these supposedly conservative investors, like foreign central banks and mutual funds and things like that, they were loading up on these mortgage-backed securities because they were buying the lower tranches. Because normally, if you're dealing with a pension fund or something, you're managing somebody's pension, you're not supposed to be buying mortgages because that's risky. But it seemed like, oh, well, we can be safe if we buy these mortgage-backed securities because they're diversified. We're not just buying mortgages in San Diego. We're buying little bits of mortgages spread across the whole country. So we're fine because even if one or two cities for some reason has a housing bust, it's not like the whole country is going to have a housing bust because that never happens. That was their thinking. And it seemed great for a while when housing kept going up. It was like they're making money hand over fist, and they thought they had good risk controls in place. Okay, so there's that issue. Another thing you have heard a lot about is probably mark-to-market accounting. This can get really complicated, so let me just give you the very broad 30,000-foot view. The issue here was, think of it in terms of the accounting and the assets and liabilities that we went over in the first week of this course. It's when you ask, is a firm solvent, what does that mean? Or is it bankrupt? What does that mean? We say, oh, are its assets higher than its liabilities? But in practice, what does that mean? Do you mean like right now at any given moment in time? Do you just say, what are the current market prices of everything on your books? And if you just sold them all in a fire sale today, within the next 2 minutes, could you then pay off all your creditors? Because if that's what you're asking, then maybe you would be insolvent if you're in the middle of a credit crunch. So what was happening is when the crisis kicked in and certain firms became suspect, it set in motion this chain reaction so that like a particular firm would be in trouble. It would normally be rolling over its short-term loans, and then we had the so-called credit crunch or credit freeze that was kicking in certain areas, certainly by the September of 2008. And so then what happened is, okay, these firms that were used to just having really good short-term credit and able to, they would borrow short and lend long. So they would take in money, issuing commercial paper or other things, I'm making these numbers up, at borrowing at 3%, and then they would invest in longer-term assets that were earning them 10%. So they're making this big spread, and that's how they made their money. But then when people started panicking, and particularly when they started thinking that, oh my gosh, some of these firms, what they invested in were these mortgage-backed securities that now are suspect because all these houses are underwater, and we think all these people are going to stop making their mortgage payments. I don't want to lend short-term to these firms anymore. And so everybody just clammed up because they didn't know how bad the situation was, and they didn't know, well, who's holding all these toxic assets. So everything freezes up. But then it just started mushrooming because now a firm that may have been solvent but now has short-term funding problems, right, because they owe people money because they borrowed for like 30 days to invest in these longer-term assets, well, the assets haven't matured yet. Like on the books, no, this is still good. This was a good investment for us to make. We borrowed at 3%. We invested in what's going to pay off at 10%. That's great. But oops, that 3% loan is now due because the terms on that were 30-day, and we just thought we would roll it over and borrow from somebody else for another 30 days, and we just thought we'd keep doing that. But now the credit market's frozen up, and no one wants to lend to us at 3%. Maybe we have to pay 15%, or maybe we can't get a loan at all. So now what do? Well, we have to start selling off those 10% return assets that we were going to hold. And so firms start dumping things on the market. Well, what happens when people start dumping something on the market? Its price goes down. So the issue is that would set in motion a chain reaction where now firms that were, because think about it, the firms that were being particularly vulnerable to this credit freeze were the ones that were holding these possibly toxic assets. Those were the firms in particular that nobody wanted to lend to anymore until this thing resolved itself. So for them to get out of that hole, what did they have to do? They had to start selling off those assets. But those are precisely the things nobody wants right now because they're not sure, whoa, the housing market's collapsing. So the price of those types of things got pushed down even more than the rational long-term estimates would have thought because now there was this panic selling because there was a scramble for liquidity by the people holding those things. But then, like I say, it sets in motion a chain reaction. Now, even another firm that actually was fine, maybe they didn't borrow short and Lem long. You know, maybe it was a hedge fund that had its money from its investors locked up. You know, that the investors couldn't come and say, "Would give us our money back." Like there was contractual things where the hedge fund was fine, but now because there's all this massive selling of these certain assets, the hedge fund's books show if we plugged in the actual market price today for these assets, now all of a sudden we're insolvent. If you use mark-to-market accounting, where you mark your assets to the market value, whatever, every day or every week or whatever the time frame is. So that was the issue where, I knew guys on Wall Street, and one of them was telling me about it, where he was working in distressed debt, meaning like he would buy bonds from companies that were in trouble, and he was sure that the company was going to make the payments on it. You know, they got to buy the bonds at a low value because the company was in trouble, but you know, he did his research and he thought, no, the market's underpricing this bond. They're going to be fine. They're not going to miss any of their payments. And after 5 years, when all is said and done, we're going to have gotten these bonds at a bargain that we paid a little bit for them compared to the actual cash flow that we're going to get out of them. It's just people weren't sure back when we bought it, and so that's why we got it at such a discount. But the problem was, as people were panicked and were selling those things, the actual market price of those things went down. And so his hedge fund's books made it look like all of a sudden their assets were really low compared to their liabilities. And so they got in trouble, and then what would happen is it would spread beyond even the toxic assets. So firms that were holding a bunch of these toxic assets, they realized we can't make do by selling off the toxic assets because no one wants them. The price we'd get for them is piddly. So they had to start selling the good stuff, you know, things that had nothing to do with the mortgage industry. And so then that again further made these ripples. So there were crazy situations where even firms that had stayed totally away from these toxic assets and knew we're not getting into this mortgage-backed securities because there's some crazy stuff going on. This is going to blow up. So go ahead and earn your short-term profits, but we're going to steer clear of that. If they happen to hold a bunch of assets that these other risky players also owned in addition to their toxic assets, those risky players now, while they're sinking, they start doing fire sales of their good stuff too to try to just fend off bankruptcy. And then that pushes down the market price of all those good assets. So now the firms that happen to be stockpiling those particular types of assets, now all of a sudden their balance sheet gets destroyed. Even though they're just minding their own business and they have no liquidity problems, all of a sudden, boom, you know, their assets drop 20% in a month because everybody's selling that particular thing and no one's buying right now because everyone's just panicked. So that's the issue with mark-to-market accounting. And if you have regulations in place that say you have to, according to, you know, GAAP or whatever, you have to report your books and mark-to-market at the close of every business day or the close of every week or whatever the specific regulations are, people were arguing that gave a very misleading picture of the financial health of certain companies. And so, and then, you know, it would force you to sell in certain cases to pay off people so you could reduce your liabilities. And it was just like my friend was saying that, you know, he's a very free market guy, but he was saying there were certain crazy things where you clearly, the correct thing to do would be to hold this asset, that it was a good thing to hold, it was going to pay off, and yet you were forced to sell it for way less than you knew it was worth just because of the stupid way that the rules worked. So anyway, that's the issue with mark-to-market accounting. So let's move on here. Okay, credit default swaps. This is, so this was a big deal with AIG, and let me just clarify. So AIG was American General Insurance Company, and that was the main one that fell in September of 2008. The Fed had to come in and take it over, or not that the Fed had to, but that the Fed did. And let me just clarify, their conventional insurance business was fine, right? So they would issue life insurance and stuff like that. That side of the business was fine. Where they got into trouble is with these things called credit default swaps that were, they're a form of insurance, but they're not conventional insurance. So what a credit default swap or a CDS is, it's basically a type of insurance on a financial event or a credit event. So the example I'm talking about here is, let's say some foreign investment bank owns bonds issued by Chrysler, and then they're worried, well, what if Chrysler defaults? And so what they can do is they go to AIG and say, hey, we effectively want to take out an insurance policy on this credit event. So if Chrysler defaults on its bonds, we want you, AIG, to pay us. And then why would AIG agree to that? Well, because the foreign investment bank pays AIG premium payments. So it's just like taking out fire insurance that in the event that this awful event happens, it's going to cause me a lot of financial loss. The insurance company makes me whole. But then to get them to be willing to do that, of course, I have to pay them monthly payments. So that's what a credit default swap is. You're paying the issuer of the CDS for them to pledge that they will compensate you in the event of what's called a credit event. One of the interesting things about this is you don't have to own the thing that pertaining to the credit event. So in normal insurance, you have to have what's called an insurable interest in order to get the policy issued. So if I want to get fire insurance on a building, I have to either be the owner of the building or I have to show that, you know, maybe I'm a retail outlet and the building is this manufacturer of a product that's like a big part of my business. And even though I don't own the building, it would really hurt my business if that building happened to burn down. So maybe I could argue to the insurance company, hey, I want to take out a fire insurance policy on that building, even though I don't own it, because if that building happened to burn down, it would really kill my business. So maybe they would. But the point is, you gotta prove that you somehow lose if the event happens. Whereas with credit default swaps, you didn't have to do that at all. And so people would say, it's like if you went to the fire insurance company and said, I want to pay you monthly premiums, and if my neighbor's house burns down, then you send me a check for $500,000. So if you had it, if you kind of knew your neighbor smoked a lot and you knew he didn't have smoke alarms and you knew that he had a lot of, you know, he liked to have gasoline sitting around in the living room or something, you might then realize, whoa, I bet you, you know, the fire insurance company doesn't realize that stuff. I'm going to go and take out a fire insurance policy on my neighbor's house because I bet you that thing's going to go up. Or the price the insurance company's charging me to take out a policy for $500,000 is way too low compared to the risk that I know my neighbor's house is in. So that's one of the issues that people are talking about with these credit default swaps. One last little tidbit on this is that a lot of people, since I'm referring to this last bullet point here, it says AIG was hurt by calls for more collateral, not by defaults per se. So one of the interesting things that people were criticizing the guy who designed the computer models that AIG was using to evaluate these risks. All right, so again, with all this stuff, these people aren't stupid. In fact, it's the opposite. They were really smart, and that made them overconfident. They thought they had everything under control, and obviously they didn't. But don't ever say that, oh, I had these idiots on Wall Street. They weren't idiots. I mean, you could say they were fools, but they weren't stupid. So the interesting thing here with the AIG incident is, if you go and really look at the analysis and dig into it, it really wasn't that the computer models were totally off. So AIG, when it was pricing how much should we charge for premiums to issue these credit default swaps and what are the probabilities we assign to these various credit events, blah, 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 it's not like they were totally off in terms of how much are we going to have to pay out and, oh, man, we didn't charge enough up front. That's not what happened. What happened was when the financial crisis really started kicking in September of 2008, a bunch of these big firms who were holding a bunch of credit default swaps issued by AIG got nervous and thought, you know, AIG isn't going to be able to pay us, right? It'd be like if you had a bunch of fire insurance policy issued by this one company and you realized all of a sudden that all your neighbors all had fire insurance issued by the same company, and then you saw a big fire coming, you know, forest fire coming down the street, and you realize, oh man, our whole neighborhood's going to get wiped out. Now all of a sudden your fire insurance policy wouldn't be so appealing because you're thinking, if the insurance company goes down, well, great, I have this policy, but they have no assets left because all my neighbors, their houses got burned down too. So that was kind of the issue here. And so some of the big companies said to AIG, we want you to put up more collateral. Like, you know, so AIG, like, put it somewhere that AIG, like, that, those are assets they're not going to touch, like assets devoted to backing up their outstanding credit default swaps. And then AIG couldn't do that. And that's what actually made them get into trouble when the Fed came in. But it wasn't that all these defaults happened, all these credit events, and then AIG just started writing checks and realized, uh-oh, we're out of money. That's not what happened. Okay, this issue of so-called breaking the buck. So money market mutual funds, or MMMFs, what they do is they take the investor's money and then they buy allegedly very safe securities, such as what's called high-grade commercial paper. And what that means is short-term corporate bonds that are considered very safe. And then, so, it's not worth getting into here with the time constraints, but it's sort of like as that grows, they control how many shares there are of the mutual fund, and investors want to have a stable share price of a dollar. But at any given time, you know, once they've issued a certain amount of outstanding shares and they have a bunch of assets backing it up, I mean, it's possible all of a sudden the market value of those assets goes way down such that the net asset value is below a dollar. So if that happens, they call that breaking the buck, meaning the net asset value drops below $1, which is $1 for foreign viewers. So that's a very rare event, but of course it's possible. And so why is it rare? Well, because normally you're only investing in very safe things, so the return is low, but you're pretty sure you're going to get the principal back. And so what happened is because of these events in September of 2008 when Lehman failed, now all of a sudden everybody's freaking out, and Reserve Primary Fund, which was a major money market mutual fund, all of a sudden had a net asset value of only 97 cents per share. So that was also considered a really huge thing. So now everybody is panicking because, I mean, for a lot of people, the standard investor would refer to money market mutual funds as cash. Right? It's not literally cash. It's not literally a demand deposit at a commercial bank. But for a lot of people, if they say, like, you know, oh, I got out of the market and I went into cash, you know, they could mean a lot of things by that. They probably don't mean I sold off all of my stock and I literally have $100 bills under my mattress. They probably mean I bought treasuries or I put it in a commercial bank, or they might even mean I put it in a money market mutual fund, which is certainly not cash in a narrow, literal sense. But what it means is it takes your money and then it goes out and buys very short-term corporate bonds that are considered extremely safe. So you're not in the, you know, they say I'm not in the market, they mean I don't own equities is what they mean by that. Okay, so now people are panicked because this was supposed to be sacrosanct. You were considered being real safe and conservative. You put your money in the reserve primary fund. You weren't going after yield. You just wanted to maintain your principal. And now all of a sudden, what? It went down to 97 cents per share. So this is like, holy cow. Lehman fails, this happens, everybody's panicked, so what do? They start trying to withdraw their money from the money market mutual funds, right? So they go up to the mutual fund and say, give me my money back, I'm going to go put it literally in a bank where I know I've got FDIC that insures my deposits up to a certain amount, because technically there's no guarantee for a mutual fund, it's just historically, it's kind of unprecedented, or not unprecedented, but fairly unheard of that it would break the buck, and now this just happened, so everyone's panicked. So the point was, people were scrambling to put their money somewhere safe, because all these traditional safety, these refuges were collapsing. I mean, it was inconceivable in 2005 that Lehman Brothers might fail in a couple of years. That would have been just impossible. Or that Bear Stearns would get taken over. It'd be crazy, some talk like that. And yet this stuff was happening. So it started to run on these funds, meaning people wanted to withdraw it. And again, it's the same sort of issue. These funds got into trouble. So now people want to make withdrawals, so they have to start selling off their assets to raise the money to give the customers their money back. And so that's pushing down the price of these assets. And so now all of a sudden corporations can't borrow short term, right? The market for high grade commercial paper is collapsing because the traditional buyers, namely these money market mutual funds, are having to liquidate because their customers are wanting to withdraw their money. So things are all flipped around, and so now corporations that are used to being able to go into the short-term market and borrowing money very cheaply, now all of a sudden they can't, or the interest rate's really high. So it's just screwing up everything, and again, you had this issue of the type of assets that these money market mutual funds held. Now all of a sudden their market price is going down because there's a fire sale. And so that would make, you know, that could have set in motion a chain reaction where now other money market mutual funds might see them, you know, their net asset value is going below a dollar. So to allegedly to avoid that, the Treasury comes in and just says, okay, we're insuring the net asset value of money market mutual funds at a dollar. So they basically took like FDIC and applied it to not just commercial banks, but money market mutual funds. The thinking being, we got to just stop this run. So the same mentality that's used to justify deposit insurance. Okay, let's look at credit spreads here. So what this chart is showing you are the average Moody's average yields for different types of securities. So AAA, of course, means very safe corporate bonds, AAA corporate bond yield. BAA means not as safe. And then 7-year treasuries are 7-year bonds issued by the U.S. federal government. So you can see what happened. Traditionally, you know, these rates could go up and down, but notice that they tend to move in tandem, right, all through here. The green one, which is the U.S. Treasuries, that's always lower, and the red one, which is the BAA, is higher, and the blue is in the middle, which is the AAA. And that makes sense, right, that the U.S. government is considered the safest lender on the planet, or, yeah, not lender, borrower on the planet. So you're going to lend money to some institution, what's often treated as a riskless loan is to the U.S. federal government. You can either think that's funny or not, but the point is because they can tax, and so they can always pay you back. There's a good chance, whereas companies, if customers stop giving them money, the companies can't send guys with guns to get payment the way the government can. So it makes sense, the ordering of these colored lines, but notice what happened during the financial crisis. There was a divergence that the yield on AAA bonds was gently falling. It spiked a little bit, but on BAA went way up, and on U.S. Treasuries went way down. And so this right here was a flight to safety. And people were really panicked, and so they were getting – so it's – you can't just speak of what happened to interest rates during the financial panic. Notice that divergence where people were getting rid of dubious corporate bonds, and they were rushing into treasuries. And here in this next chart, I'm looking at just the spread, and you can read the Fred notation. It's what this is showing is the yield on the Moody's BAA corporate bonds minus the yield on 7-year treasuries. So you can see that historically, it's that gap is typically below 3%, and it occasionally spikes, but then in the during the crisis period, it went way up. And so that difference shows the premium people were placing on safety. So this wasn't an issue of, oh, time preference went up, and that's why the yield on the BAAs went up. This was an issue of people were panicked, and they wanted to have money that they thought was sure. They wanted to put their principal somewhere. So they piled into commercial bank deposits and U.S. Treasuries, and they got out of things like even money market mutual funds and certainly out of BAA corporate bonds. Okay, and this is you may have heard of this thing called the TED spread, and that's a popular indicator of financial fear. And so what it is, it's the LIBOR minus U.S. Treasury. And so you can see, you know, and this legend tells you what the different lines are here. So the blue is the U.S. Treasury yield. The green is LIBOR. So typically the green is higher. And then the gap between them is what is called the TED spread. And so notice, you know, this red line is typically pretty low. And then boom, it went way up here in the latter half or last quarter of 2008 because the LIBOR went way up while the yield on treasuries went way down. Okay, liquidity versus capital. So this is an issue. Let me just talk about this briefly. So banks worry about leverage, not just reserve requirement. So you heard this a lot when the crisis was first unfolding, that a lot of economists were talking about, well, the Fed's cut interest rates, and man, those reserves are piling up into the system. I don't understand why banks aren't lending more. And then a lot of more sophisticated people would come along and they would say, well, what you don't understand is banks right now are capital constrained. They're not liquidity constrained, and that's why they're not lending. So what does that mean? If we had more time, I would walk you through the balance sheet, but the issue is, let's say all of a sudden a financial firm, it has a bunch of assets like mortgage-backed securities and so forth, and it loses, you know, those assets go down, so it loses $1 billion off of its assets. Right? The left-hand side of its balance sheet drops by $1 billion. Well, that means the right-hand side has to drop by $1 billion. If the liabilities didn't go down, what happens is capital took a hit. It's shareholder equity. So using a measure of leverage, which would look at your liabilities compared to your equity or your capital, now all of a sudden the bank is more levered. And so if the Fed comes along and says to the commercial bank, oh, hey, don't worry, we'll buy some assets off of you and give you reserves in exchange. And so, you know, that operation per se, so if the Fed comes along and the commercial bank was holding $10 billion worth of treasuries and the Fed buys it and then gives it $10 billion in reserves now, well, it's true that the commercial bank now has a bunch more reserves. And so if you looked at its outstanding customer deposits and then its reserves, now all of a sudden, oh, it has tons of excess reserves. So legally, it would be allowed to go make more loans to expand its customer deposits. But that's not the full story. The Fed just coming in and buying treasuries and then giving them reserves doesn't actually raise their assets. All it does is change their composition. So if the bank had been uncomfortably levered because of the loss in asset value, then all of a sudden its equity compared to its liabilities is too low. The fact that the Fed comes in and dumps a bunch of reserves into the system, that's not going to alleviate that problem. And so that was the issue with TARP, that what TARP was supposed to do, what it ended up doing in practice when the federal government, so don't get confused, the Federal Reserve didn't do TARP. It was the U.S. federal government, the Treasury, that did TARP. Here it was the Treasury was injecting capital. It wasn't simply lending. Or at least that was the theory behind it. A lot of this stuff gets real nuanced. Okay, so just think of it as if you're a company, you know, why would you, what would you, the issue of debt versus equity financing? There is this distinction. So if you're a small company and you want to build a factory, like you have really good sales, and you're like, oh man, this is great. We got one factory right now, we're just cranking out orders. We want to expand operations. Well, there's two, and so you're saying, oh, I want to build another $1 million factory so we can double our output, because I think that we have the business there and we'll just expand, it'll be great. So how do you raise that $1 million? There's two ways to do it. You can either go into more debt or you can issue equity. And there's pros and cons of that, and we went over that stuff in the lecture dealing with the balance sheet mechanics. So if you issue more debt, you're just selling off bonds and borrowing money from people. So now if you hit a home run and the thing's a success, you just pay off the interest rate on the debt, and then you get to keep all the profits. But if issuing equity, you're going to say, hey, I want to dilute my own ownership. I'm going to issue more shares. So other people in the community now are going to pay me money. That's where I'm going to get the $1 million from. We're going to use it to go buy this new factory or assemble this new factory. But now if we hit a home run, I'm sharing the profits with all you guys because you guys are all part owners now. So the potential for my reward now is diminished. But in case the factory is not a home run and we actually the sales are lackluster, well, now I'm spreading that loss among all the new owners too. I don't have to give them their money back because they bought into the company. Whereas the people who borrowed from me, if I do it the debt route, I owe them the money one way or the other. So that's the issue. So a lot of these firms, the point was, just because the Fed had pushed interest rates down and they could all borrow very cheaply, that isn't the end of the story. If you had a bunch of your assets take a huge hit, now you're really nervous. You don't want to do major investment projects now on borrowed money. What you want is a bunch more people to come in and buy equity in your firm to get your asset or get your capital base back up before then you start investing more. So that was that's this distinction between debt versus equity or liquidity versus capital. The point was, because a lot of these major firms had huge asset write-downs, the fact that now interest rates were pushed to zero, that didn't do anything. That didn't fix the problem. Because the issue wasn't that they couldn't have access to liquidity. The issue was they needed capital. They needed to be recapitalized. And so that was part of the theory behind what they did with TARP. Okay, quantitative easing. Let's run through this. So there's different interpretations of what the actual term means. So it suggests to you that they mean quantitative as opposed to qualitative, but that's not too helpful. So I've seen two different explanations, and I don't know if one of them is definitive or not, but one explanation says that, okay, well, the difference between conventional easing and now quantitative easing is how they report the variable of interest or what the target is. That before, when the press would talk about what the Fed was doing and when the Fed would announce what it was doing, it would just talk about changes in the target interest rate, the Fed funds rate. But now, since the rise of quantitative easing, the Fed doesn't talk merely about what their target is, because in some cases the target, if it's already between 0 and 25 basis points, they can't do it. So now what does the Fed have to do if it wants to let the markets know that, hey, we're going to do more? They're going to say how much they're buying. Whereas in 2002, when the Greenspan Fed announced, oh, they had a meeting, once again, because of the recession, we're lowering interest rates. They didn't say, and to do that, we're going to buy $87 billion worth of treasuries. They didn't talk about what they were doing. They just said, we're going to lower interest rates. Whereas now, with quantitative easing, notice the Fed specifically tells you, this is how much we're going to spend, or this is how much we plan on spending. So that's one difference, and I've seen some people say that's what quantitative easing means, is they're telling you the quantity of money they're going to spend, whereas before they never talked about that. But then I've seen other economists say, no, what quantitative easing has to do with is that it's shifting the longer-term interest rates. That conventional policy focused on the short-term rate, well, that tool is rendered moot at this point because short rates are basically zero. So now the Fed's got to do something else, so now it's going to start pushing down long rates. And the means by which it does it is to buy things like mortgage-backed securities and 30-year treasuries and that kind of stuff to push down long rates. And so that's what quantitative easing is. So like I say, I've seen both theories, and I don't know if one of them is definitive. Okay, what we refer to as QE1 started actually, depending on how you classify it, the actual purchasing started in late 2008, but in the March 2009 meeting, they formalized what they were doing, and they said, okay, we're going to buy $1.3 trillion in mortgage-backed securities and treasuries. So that's when everybody, that's if you wanted to put a date on it, say, when did the Fed announce QE1, that's when it would be. And then QE2, incidentally, the Fed never called it QE2. It's just that's what the financial press started referring to it as. It was hinted at as early as August 2010, meaning various Fed officials were saying things that were more and more like, oh, at the next meeting, we're really taking this into consideration, and and sort of letting people know, hey, we don't want to do something before the election, but once the election happens, boom, we're going to come in with another round of asset purchases, right? So they weren't literally promising it, but the markets came to believe it more and more that this was coming. And eventually what they were going to do is buy $600 billion in long-term treasuries. And the official announcement came at the Fed meeting in November 2010. Okay, so here's something interesting. With this chart, what I'm doing is showing the red line is the S&P 500, and the blue line is the monetary base, as reported by the St. Louis Fed. So notice, I went back to 2000 because I wanted to show you what it looked like in a previous recession. So here you see the S&P dropping from 1500 down to 800, and then it sharply rebounds. And notice the monetary base, you don't see it doing anything special except just a general increase during that period. In contrast, the monetary base and the S&P have moved fairly closely in our current crisis. In particular, if you look at the stock market and see when it turned around, it was very close to the Fed's announcement of QE1. You know, so you say the stock market here is crashing, and then boom, it seems to turn around on a dime. What's going on right here? I've seen different theories. One person said it was the mark-to-market rule change, but this also happened right around March 2009. So you can make a plausible case that once the markets thought, okay, the Fed is just buying stuff now, we're fine. Bernanke doesn't care. I mean, when Bernanke says we're going to spend $1.3 trillion buying mortgage-backed securities and treasuries, because keep in mind, buying mortgage-backed securities, that's something new. The Fed traditionally would only buy government debt. So for them to come in and say, oh, the housing market's in trouble and this mortgage-backed securities, these assets are in trouble, oh, well, we're just going to start buying them. That kind of reassured everybody, oh, okay, there's a backstop in place. If we can't get private buyers to take this stuff, Bernanke's going to just print up money and take it from us. So that kind of was a self-fulfilling prophecy and fixed the problem. Because now they know if Bernanke's going to take it, well, I mean, just think it through. It's kind of interesting. If the Fed's willing to buy this stuff that previously was considered a toxic asset, now all of a sudden it's not toxic anymore. Now people are willing to hold it to maturity because they know if I needed to dump it, Bernanke will take it. And so now all of a sudden the pressure comes off. So it's this ironic thing. What's his name? Mick Rowe, this Canadian monetary theorist who's a really sharp guy, in a somewhat flippant post, he called it the Chuck Norris effect. And he was saying, he meant it more generally than just this issue of mortgage-backed securities, but his point was, if Chuck Norris walks into a room and says, I'm going to fight everybody in here, everybody just backs off because it's Chuck Norris. And so he actually doesn't ever have to fight. It's just his willingness to fight makes him get whatever he wants. And so by the same token here, the point is the Fed just announcing what it's going to do, if people believe it, it might not actually have to do it because people react to it. So if the Fed wants to come in and rescue the mortgage-backed security market, if it just says we're going to, you know, if need be, we'll buy every last mortgage-backed security on planet Earth, and even if that means we got to create $10 trillion, we'll do it. If people believe that, well, now all of a sudden the Fed doesn't need to buy much because now private buyers will pay par value for these things because they know, oh, Bernanke will buy it if push comes to shove. So, yeah, I'll buy that thing. So that's the issue. Okay, so just notice with this chart, so the S&P rebounds right when you can see the effect of QE1. Look at the increase in the monetary base. And then notice, oh, the base level's off, and that's when the S&P collapses again, and then boom, it shoots up again, and that's when the S&P rebounds. Now here, it fell and rose when the base was flat, so you know, we could argue about what's going on there. But the point is, the timing of QE1 and QE2 matches pretty closely the stock market turning around. Okay, what about QE2 and interest rate? Did it work? Well, this is a nuanced thing, so it's kind of funny. If the point of QE2 were to lower medium-term interest rates, which a lot of people said the whole point was, you could argue that it had the exact opposite effect, that you can see back in April of 2010, five-year treasuries were at about, what, 2.7%. They were gradually declining. And then, boom, they bottom out and then sharply increase when? In November of 2010, right when QE2 was formally announced. So at the time, I was just poking fun at some of the people. There was a guy at National Review Online who, it was like one of these market monetarist guys. And he was just sort of stating it like it was self-evident that the benefits of QE2 and why we needed QE3. And he was saying, you know, lowered interest rates, making it easier for businesses to do this. And I said, whoa, you mean lowered interest rates? I put this chart up. Then prima facie, face value, it looked like interest rates were falling, and then boom, turned around into diamonds, shot way up right after the announcement of QE2. So you can't just assert that it worked. And if you want to say what would be the theoretical mechanism, well, you could argue five-year interest rates include some inflation expectations, and so if the Fed's printing up $600 billion to buy more bonds, well, maybe now people say, oh, prices are going to be higher, or they think if the Fed's willing to do this, the Fed's going to do QE3 and QE4 and QE5, so that's going to make prices higher, so maybe now we better charge more before we lend money to government. Now, I was sort of being cute with that. I was just challenging the guy because he was saying it like it was self-evident that it worked when it looks like it didn't. In reality, things are really nuanced with this stuff. So what could have happened is people could have expected an announcement, and then, you know, because remember, the Fed officials were hinting as early as August that this was going to happen, and perhaps even earlier people were thinking it was coming. So it could be falling just because people kind of think it's coming. And then when it turns around, I saw a lot of conservative economists saying, well, what happened here was the elections, because this is when the Republicans just spanked all the Democrats, and when Obama said, oh, we got a shellacking. And so if you believed in smaller government and you thought the Republicans were going to give it to you, or more cynically, if you thought the way to halt U.S. government spending would be to have a President Obama in a staunchly conservative Tea Party Congress, well, that's what you got. And so then people said maybe now everybody expected better economic growth because of the elections. And so interest rates went up because people thought there was going to be better growth. And so that's why you would, because now you could earn more in different types of assets, you needed to be compensated more to be willing to lend to the government, because now there are other alternatives that were more attractive. So that's, there are economic models that show interest rates could respond to long-term growth expectations. And so the way those people would talk is they'd say this downward trend here was because investors became more and more pessimistic about the economy. But then this turnaround was, whoa, the electorate really is mad at Obama, and they're totally rejecting Obama's plans, and they're putting all these Tea Party people. So if I'm a supply-side person, and I believe in small government, now I'm much more optimistic that we're going to get tax cuts and spending restraint and blah, blah, blah. Okay, let me just jump ahead here and see how much time we got to go here. Okay, I am taking a lot of time doing this. I think what I'm going to do, I will carry some of this lecture over until next week, because it's not that I'm babbling here, it's just there's a lot of material. So I'm not, instead of me rushing through and trying to do all the remaining slides, I will stop at the normal time, and then I'll next week I'll have the beginning, I'll wrap up some of this. Okay, because I think a lot of you, this is probably the lecture where you're getting more, this is the stuff where I'm telling you about the current crisis that you wouldn't be able to get from reading Rothbard or something like that. Okay, interest on excess reserves. So here, this is a chart of excess reserves. That's what this blue line is. So notice, historically, very close to zero, and then all of a sudden this crisis, boom, it just keeps shooting up. So right now it's about $1.5 trillion. So what does that mean? Well, part of what it means is that banks aren't lending. And so this is part of the explanation when you want to understand why is it that Bernanke has been doing all these crazy things, how come gasoline's not $30 a gallon? How come a loaf of bread isn't $5 a loaf? Well, part of it is the money that Bernanke has created out of thin air is largely sitting in the commercial banking system and is not being lent out. And the way you would see that is that excess reserves would go way up and just stay there. So there are many explanations for why this is happening. One is simply that this issue of liquidity versus capital, that the commercial banks, yeah, they have plenty of liquidity. They got plenty of reserves. They're not reserve constrained, but they're capital constrained. They don't want to make new loans because that would increase their leverage. They want to restore their capital first before they start lending again. Another explanation is more straightforward, that just says the lending environment's terrible right now. Who the heck are you going to lend to? And on the demand side, a lot of people are saying businesses and households right now think that they have too much debt, so they don't want to go to a bank and borrow more. They're trying to pay off their debt to become leaner and to be able to weather this thing better, because right now they don't like having all this debt hanging over their head. So there are different explanations for why is it that Bernanke pumps all this money, all his reserves into the system, and banks aren't lending more. One particular explanation is to say, well, maybe it's because Bernanke is literally paying banks not to lend money. And what that means is it's the Fed starting in, I think they actually started doing it in October of 2008. They may have done it in September of 2008. I'm not sure exactly when they started doing it. Was they started paying interest on excess reserves. So the issue here is, if you're a commercial bank and you have reserves on deposit with the Fed, they would figure out, okay, which portion of your reserves are required reserves, in other words, what you need to back up your customer demand deposits according to the reserve requirements. So those are required reserves, okay. But then if you have reserves over and above that amount, those are called excess reserves, and the Fed began paying you interest on those excess reserves. So just like you with a conventional checking account that you have with your bank, you got $100 in there. Next month, you might get your statement, and if you just don't touch it, you might have $100.10 because you earned 10 cents interest on your deposit. And so that's what the Fed started doing with the commercial banks that were depositing funds with the Fed, whereas it hadn't done that before. Okay, so up till this point, the Fed did not pay interest on excess reserves. If a commercial bank kept excess reserves with the Fed, it would just park there and earn nothing. And so that was one of the reasons that the banks historically would have excess reserves very close to zero, because there was you didn't earn any interest doing it. That'd be silly. Why would you keep your money parked there at zero when you could lend it out and earn interest on it? Okay, so what am I saying? Okay. Now, the interest rate's not all that much. It's like 25 basis points or something. But the point is, if you've got a bunch of excess reserves and you don't have many other options, that's guaranteed money. That's even safer than investing with the government, because there's no doubt that the Fed can create more reserves and give them to you. So that's what. So some people have been complaining and saying this is crazy. At the same time that the Fed is pumping all these reserves into the system, and then we're wondering why isn't the Fed lending it out, or why aren't these banks lending? Well, the Fed at the same time is literally paying banks not to make loans. Because that's how you have excess reserves, right? You don't make more loans, so you're given stockpile of total reserves. More of them are excess than not. So if you're getting paid on your excess reserves and you're not getting paid on your required reserves, on the margin, that's an incentive for you not to make a loan. All right, so why are they doing it? Well, it's funny. I haven't seen anybody else talk about this, but I distinctly remember the initial rationale for why they started doing this. Like I said, they started talking about it in September of 08. I don't know if that's when they actually implemented it or if they started doing it in October 2008. But I distinctly remember at the time, this is the rationale the Fed gave. Now, maybe they were lying, but this is what they said at the time. They're saying, okay, the reason we need to do this is because there is now a divergence between what we want to do in terms of our asset purchases and what we want our target for the federal funds rate to be. So you can see, so that what I'm graphing here is the effective federal funds rate, so that means the actual market rate. They go out and look and see what are commercial banks actually charging each other for overnight loans of reserves, and that's the effective federal funds rate, contrasted with the federal funds target rate. So that's what the Fed would announce as this is our policy objective until the next meeting when we update what our objective is. So that's why the blue line is bouncing around, because it's a market rate, and the red line is flat, because that was just when they would update their target. Now you just discontinuously shift to a new plateau. So notice historically, the two things tended to move together. But then from this point onward, look at how the actual federal funds rate was lower than the target, significantly lower, and then it would stay there. And so what the Fed claimed was going on is they were saying, we're coming in and we're doing all kinds of stuff in terms of assets to help the credit markets. Like, we're rescuing AIG and we're starting to buy mortgage-backed securities and we're doing this. And so the Fed is buying all these assets and in so doing is injecting more reserves into the system. So that, as normally happens when the Fed wants to buy assets, that increases reserves, that pushes down the price of borrowing reserves. So that pushes down the federal funds rate. But for whatever reason, they didn't want the federal funds rate to be that low. And so what they said at the time was, so in other words, just make sure you understand what I'm saying. Like here at, So October of 2008, around that, you know, a few weeks before and after, in this period here, the actual target for the federal funds rate was still 2%. So again, it took the Fed a while, and even here it's only 1%. And this is in the, you know, November and December of 2008. So this is after the crisis has already kicked in. So the Fed did not immediately push interest rates all the way down to basically zero. It took them a while to get there. So in this period, the federal funds rate here is still 2%, but yet banks in the actual market are willing to lend each other reserves for, you know, 1.25%, something like that. So there's this big gap, and you can see it wasn't disappearing. And so the Fed wanted to be able to prop up the actual federal funds rate, but it didn't want to sell off assets, right? Because the Fed thought it would be contractionary, and we'd be hurting the economy if we started selling off our assets, like mortgage-backed securities and treasuries and whatever, in order to suck reserves out of the system. So what can we do? So the problem was we had this divergence. That normally the Fed just focuses on moving the federal funds rate, and it thinks that just changing that interest rate, everything fixes itself. But here, because you had all of these specific problems that they were worried about, specific dislocations in the financial sector, or if you're more cynical, they realized some of their big buddies were in trouble and they need to just shovel billions of dollars to those guys. They wanted to be able to do these one-shot targeted interventions and buy specific assets, but they didn't want that to push down the federal funds rate. So what do you do? What do you do? Oh, I know. In addition to buying all these assets and expanding our balance sheet, increasing reserves and putting pressure on the federal funds rate to go down, at the same time, we will start spending more money from the Fed's point of view. We'll start writing more checks, this time to commercial banks, telling them, if you don't lend your fund, your reserves in the interbank market, we'll pay you interest. And so now the banks would stop lending each other reserves because, or on the margin, they would be less likely to do so because now the Fed's paying them 25 basis points. So the issue is, you know, at this point, like here, do I want to lend to somebody else at 50 basis points, another bank that might fail, or do I want to just keep my reserves parked at the Fed and get 25 basis points guaranteed? And so it put a floor under it, and that was the initial rationale. Now, let me make just two more points, then I'll stop tonight's lecture, and we'll wrap up the rest next week. So what's funny about all this, and again, there's an obvious counter response, but people were talking like it was self-evident when it wasn't. Like I said, with the issue of did QE2 lower interest rates, and well, no, if you look at the numbers, it didn't. You'd have to make some counterfactual argument about why interest rates would have been higher otherwise. The same thing here. So this is commercial and industrial loans at all commercial banks. People are talking like all the extraordinary Fed interventions starting from September 2008 onward were to rescue private lending and to stop the credit crunch and all this because, hey, we got to give loans to small businesses. They're the lifeblood of the economy. Well, okay, so this is banks, commercial, industrial loans. You can see they're rising, rising, rising. The recession starts. They're still going up. Okay, boom. They peak right at October 2008, and then they fall like a stone. So, again, if you're just looking at the data naively and say, did the Fed's actions work or not? Did it get banks to lend more to small businesses or regular businesses? Just looking at the data, you would say no. If anything, it was the exact opposite. Now, in fairness, and I made this point when I was the one time I was on Larry Kudlow's show, and the people there were acting like I was an idiot, and they were going, well, I mean, it's counterfactual. And they just moved on to see if Geithner had gravitas. I'm not even kidding. That was the issue. Does Geithner have gravitas? But what they were saying is, well, if it hadn't been for the Fed doing that, then the real line would have been like this. And so the fact that the actual blue line is higher than what otherwise would have happened shows the Fed helped. And that, of course, bank lending is going to drop like a stone once the crisis hits. So, and that's, you know, fair enough. But, again, the point was people are just talking like it's self-evident that these rescue emergency Fed programs were rejuvenating lending to businesses when, no, they weren't. Or at least, according to the data, lending to businesses was rising and rising and rising and peaked right when the Fed started doing all this crazy stuff. So if you wanted to make a case that the Fed paying interest on excess reserves led to commercial banks not lending, you could just make a pretty straightforward case looking at the data. Okay, last point I'll make in this lecture, and then like I say, I'll carry over the remaining slides till next week and and do them quickly at the beginning of the last week's lecture. This issue of the Fed's exit strategy, now this is where people now talk about the purpose of excess reserves. So the claim is that interest on reserves will prevent massive price inflation once reserves start getting lent out. All right, that's probably a horrible sentence grammatically. All right, so what people claim is the true purpose now of having this tool of interest on excess reserves, and it's not just random people. I mean, Bernanke himself has said this. He's saying, we don't need to worry. You know, critics are talking about, oh, we've got $1.5 trillion of excess reserves in the system for various reasons. The banks haven't been lending, but what happens when they do start lending? And now all of a sudden, because with the money multiplier, it's not just dollar for dollar, the excess reserves. I mean, if there's $1 trillion in excess reserves and the banks lend 10 times of that, well, that's an extra $10 trillion in money now that's in the hands of the public. So we could have massive effects on prices. So Bernanke says, oh, don't worry about that. If that ever started happening, we would just increase the interest rate we're paying on excess reserves. So we could always just bribe the banks enough so that they don't find it advantageous to lend. So instead of them, you know, if the market interest rate now on a loan goes to 8%, and so a bank is about to give a loan to a business person at 8%, we, the Fed, will just come along and increase our excess reserve payment to 4%. And so now the banker says, well, I could engage in this risky loan and give some of these excess reserves to this businessman at 8%, or I could just keep them parked at the Fed and earn a guaranteed 4. So I'll earn a guaranteed 4. And the Fed can just keep bumping up the number it pays to induce people to not lend out. Okay, so again, just think of the craziness there. I mean, Bernanke is admitting that the purpose of this tool is to get banks to not lend to businesses, which sort of flies in the face of the whole alleged reason for doing this, but of all the bailouts and stuff. But my point with this is, how in the world is that an exit strategy? How in the world is that anything but the epitome of a short-term solution that makes the problem worse, and in fact exponentially worse? That if the problem is we've got $1.5 trillion or whatever the number is of excess reserves, and now all of a sudden, because the environment has changed and now we're out of the recession and businesses want to start borrowing again and commercial banks have finally recapitalized and so they start lending, and so now the issue is, if we, the Fed, don't do something, that $1.5 trillion of excess reserves is going to get multiplied into $15 trillion in new loans, and so our solution is, let's just start paying 5% interest on that. Well, then that pile of excess reserves now is growing at 5% a year. So you're not dealing with the problem. You're just making it literally grow exponentially. So what do you do next year? Well, now you've got even more excess reserves. And you say, now we increase it to 10%. And so the thing grows. So it doesn't, if you're not, because the point is, the worry is you can't just totally undo what got us into the position. Because the way those reserves got there is that the Fed expanded its balance sheet and bought a bunch of assets, and that created new reserves. So the obvious solution is, if those excess reserves are posing a problem, well, the Fed should just sell off all its assets and destroy those reserves. But they can't do that, because then that would just wreck the economy again. The financial sector would crash. And so they think they're being clever by saying, we don't have to sell off those assets. We can just pay interest on excess reserves and increase that payment to keep banks from wanting to lend out the money. So what I'm saying is, if once that problem happens, once those reserves start leaking out, if at that point you realize we can't sell off the Fed's assets and just destroy those reserves, why is that trade-off going to get better going forward? Why is it that you couldn't do it then, but next year, after having paid the bankers for a year to not make new loans, why at that point, now that you've got more excess reserves, is all of a sudden the Fed going to be willing to sell off all those assets and destroy the banking system? So Bernanke's theory is, oh, no, once the economy naturally recovers, we'll let all this stuff just gradually unwind naturally. But, you know, he's saying we don't ever have to worry about us doing a fire sale and shocking the system, because we can affect the timing and do a gradual drawdown, because if for some reason inflation started getting out of hand, we would just increase the excess reserves. But my point is, he's basically assuming this is my plan is going to work. But if something goes wrong with his plan, his tool is just going to make things worse. All right, well, why don't I stop there? Like I said, we got a few more slides that had some good stuff, so I don't want to skip it. So we'll come back and do it next week. And I know a bunch of you put questions in the Q&A, so I will deal with those during the week. I'll post the answers to those in the Moodle. All right, thanks, everybody.